Yes, I can.
Very good. Now, you're talking to us from Fairfax, Virginia?
Yes, yes, that's right.
And where do you teach?
I'm actually a patent attorney.
Aha. And how did you get interested in the New Testament?
I've been a member of the Society of Biblical Literature for about 8 years, and I've had some Latin and Greek training, which I've been keeping up with by being a member of that professional society.
Where did you learn Latin and Greek?
I'm actually in high school.
Ah. Now, when we talk about the secret gospel of Mark, you're going to be on the U of I campus here at the University of Illinois in a week or two. And you're going to be discussing this secret gospel of Mark. It was discovered fairly recently, right? References to it within the last 30, 40 years?
Yes. The secret gospel of Mark was first heard of in 1958 when a professor at Columbia University by the name of Morton Smith went back to that monastery where he had previously been. He had been invited to catalog the various manuscripts at that monastery, and among one of the manuscripts that he cataloged, there was an old printed book that came out in 1646, and on the last couple pages of that book, he cataloged a handwritten copy of a letter that says it's from Clement of Alexandria, who was a theologian who lived about 200 A.D. and he photographed it and he brought it back to the United States, and in that letter it is a private letter addressed to a certain Theodore who we don't know anything about, and in that letter it seems to answer questions that Theodore must have had about a certain secret gospel of Mark, and Clement answers those questions in the letter by quoting a passage from that text, which before 1958 nobody has ever heard of before.
And this letter that is claimed to have come from Clement of Alexandria had also never been known of before Morton Smith supposedly found it in 58.
That's right. That's right. The letter is completely new.
And why has there been such a controversy about this?
Well, it's a controversy primarily, although the Greek really doesn't support it. The letter can be kind of read, particularly in the context in which it was discovered in the mid '50s, as implying basically implying a homosexual relationship with Jesus, and that kind of got a lot of people really exercised about it. Even though the letter itself is not very clear in that, particularly if you know Greek, and so I could quote the passage that has gotten a lot of people upset.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, and this passage is
now again, this is from a letter supposedly from Clement of Alexandria from the third century of the Common Era, quoting a secret gospel of Mark that no one had heard of up to this point.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Right. And I'm going to quote Morton Smith's translation. And they came into Bethany, and a certain woman whose brother had died was there. In coming, she prostrated herself before Jesus and says to him, "Son of David, have mercy on me." But the disciples rebuked her. And Jesus, being angered, went off with her into the garden where the tomb was, and straightway a great cry was heard from the tomb. And going near, Jesus rolled away the stone from the door of the tomb, and straightway going in where the youth was, he stretched forth his hand and raised him, seizing his hand. But the youth, looking at him, loved him, and began to beseech him that he might be with him. And going out of the tomb, they came into the house of the youth, for he was rich. And after 6 days, Jesus told him what to do, and in the evening the youth comes to him wearing a linen cloth over his naked body. And he remained with him that night, for Jesus taught him the mystery of the kingdom of God. And thence, arising, he returned to the other side of the Jordan. Now Clement, after quoting that, or the letters, Clement, tells the recipient that the phrase naked man with naked man is not found in that passage. So presumably, whatever was troubling Theodore about what was in the secret gospel of Mark, Clement tells him that it doesn't involve naked men.
Now, this is a passage that, let me repeat, is not found in the canonical New Testament, the New Testament accepted by most Christians, but is purported to come from a secret gospel of Mark that... now, has that ever been found, or are there references to it ever been found?
No, there's no other reference to the secret gospel of Mark other than the text that Smith photographed in 1958. So it was completely new to everyone that there could be such a thing.
And now in the 70s, when Morton Smith wrote some books about this, a scholarly book, a popular book. What was the reaction then?
Well, the reaction, the reaction was quite out. Reaction was quite outrageous. In part for a couple of reasons. It's not just the content of the text, but it's what Smith did with that. He ended up proposing an interpretation that this involves some kind of a midnight baptism, and he published two books. One is a scholarly book that kind of goes through in huge details. It's about 400 pages, all what the Greek means and all this kind of background material. And at the same time, he published a more popular edition teasingly kind of emphasize some of the more scandalous aspects of the text. His friends were Smith's friends were somewhat bewildered because his interpretation of the text didn't seem to really be grounded in it, and in particular, Smith argued that that this text featured a baptism, even though there was no water in the scene at all, which is what you would expect with a baptism. It's just only based on the piece of clothing, a linen cloth.
And were there people who were skeptical about the authenticity of this in the 70s?
Yes. Within a couple of years after it came out, a scholar by the name of Quentin Connell published an article in the Catholic Bible Quarterly, in which he said that there's a real problem with Smith's text in that we don't have the manuscript to examine, and so Smith left it at that monastery in the middle of the desert, and no one but Smith has been able to take a look at that text.
So no one since has been able to see even this 17th century copy of it.
Right. At the time that Connell wrote, two years later, about four scholars went to the monastery library and had that text transferred to the library in Jerusalem, run by the Greek Orthodox Patriarchy. And they actually removed the sheets from the book and photographed it again, and now it's been misplaced. So we can't find it anymore. But it is clear that there was a piece of handwriting at the back of a book, just like Smith said. But no other analysis has been done on that manuscript to determine how recently that text had been written.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Stephen Carlson from Virginia by phone about the secret gospel of Mark. Stephen Carlson is a patent attorney and How did you first get interested in this whole subject?
Actually, the first time I heard of Secret Mark was when I was a teenager, and I was reading the Holy Blood, Holy Grail series, and it kind of mentioned it back then, and I thought, oh wow, this is really interesting. and then I didn't think too much more of it until I began to be more active online, and I found that there was actually quite a number of professors. This is around 95, which is about 4 years after Smith's death. Number of professors had been voicing their suspicions that they believe this text was forged, and I was surprised about how many people were saying that, and I always wondered whether this would be an interesting puzzle to try to solve.
So for you, it was an intellectual exercise to see what the evidence was on either side and make a judgment?
Very, very much so, yes.
And what have you decided?
It was kind of fascinating. The more I got into it, the more I realized what was going on. Basically appears that according to my study, the whole thing was made up by Morton Smith, primarily as a hoax, more along the lines of a practical joke than what we would consider a forgery per se. So Smith, when he put it together, embedded lots of jokes and self-references to it, and it was really quite a fascinating puzzle that Smith had prepared.
But usually practical jokers like to have the last laugh and say, look what I accomplished. Did Smith ever do that before his death in 91?
You could argue that some of these clues that he embedded were part of that, but otherwise he never publicly claimed ownership of this hoax before he died. Part of the reason maybe is that some of his friends kind of ran with the text while his enemies did not.
I see. Now when Morton Smith published these two books in 73, one popularization called The Secret Gospel, and the more scholarly one, Clement of Alexandria and The Secret Gospel of Mark, the latter was published by Cambridge University Press, right?
Harvard, yes.
It was Harvard, okay.
Yes.
So a very respectable press. Why would they do this if there was any question that it might be a forgery or a hoax?
Really, a lot of the questions were raised after it was published. Hmm. But Smith did present a lot of material seeking to authenticate it, and he had enlisted many people at Columbia and his peers to help him do that.
And what do you see as some of the evidence that it is a hoax?
Right. The first thing I did is I decided it's important to take another look at the manuscript, and there is in the legal field. There are ways of determining whether documents have been forged forensically by looking at the speed of the handwriting, the strokes done in making the writing the text, and usually forgers have to practice what they're trying to imitate, and they often draw it much more slowly than what the natural handwriting would be. This is a field that has not really been applied in biblical studies at all. Okay, it's just something that works in the legal field, and they use it for determining forged checks and the like. And if you apply those concepts in that field and look carefully at the manuscript, you find that even though the manuscript appears to be written in a very hurried or quick cursive handwriting, if you look at it closely, you could tell by the blunt ends and the pen lifts that it was actually written very much more slowly than that. It was is written by somebody who wanted to appear to make it look like the handwriting of that era, but he wrote it much more slowly than that. And I hired a professional forensic document examiner to go over my results, and she confirmed a lot of what I was saying.
Now, if Smith did forge this, when would he have done that? Roughly what year or what decade?
I think it's somewhere after 1955, when he was denied tenure at Brown, and before the summer of 1958, when he came back with the photographs of it. And some of the motivation there is a bit of revenge, but it would be in the mid-50s, probably towards the last 2 years of that, 57, 58.
Now, if Morton Smith did forge this in the 50s, how did he make it look as if it were a 17th century copy?
Well, for one, he got a very old book. Printed in 1646, called the Genuine Epistles of Ignatius, who is another early Christian from the early second century, and that book has three blank pages on the back in which he could write that in. Smith was a manuscript expert. He had previously visited Greece in 1951 and 1952. And took thousands of photographs of Greek manuscripts, many of them from the same century that the handwriting exhibits. So he had lots of samples from which to practice if that's what he wanted to do.
After Morton Smith was denied tenure at Brown University, and then made this discovery, where did he go next in terms of his academic work?
Right. For the next 2 years, which would be 56 to 57, he was visiting professor at Drew University in New Jersey, and you could see his publications already just started increasing there, and he started writing a lot more. And then 2 years there in 1957, the summer there, he obtained a professorship at Columbia.
So he was back in the tenure track, or did he go right in as a full professor?
He eventually made tenure around 1962.
Okay, at Columbia.
He had published a very successful textbook in 1960, among other things. If you look at his bibliography, is basically the rate of his publications started increasing, and they were pretty good publications too.
Now, when you became interested in this, was Smith still alive?
No. Smith passed away in 91.
91. So you got interested after that.
Yes.
Okay. And how did it feel as a practicing attorney to be looking at something that happened so recently, relatively, and trying to make decisions about it? Could you talk to his colleagues? Did you?
I talked to some people who knew him, and there are people on both sides, and so. I thought that the best way to really get to know him is to read everything he published before 1958, to know what he was thinking, what kind of topics he knew, and also, as it turns out, to get a sense of humor. Smith was a very funny man, and once you kind of get to know him, it made it easier to kind of look for clues. Once I realized he had been planting clues in the text.
Let me reintroduce our guest for those who may have tuned into this program late on this Sunday afternoon. On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking by phone from Fairfax, Virginia, to Stephen Carlson, who's a patent attorney and has been studying the secret gospel of Mark, which was purported to have been references to that were purported to have been discovered by Morton Smith, a professor at Columbia University, and in Smith's books of the 1970s about the secret gospel of Mark. If this is a live program, and if listeners would like to call and make a comment or ask a question or enter into this argument, we're delighted to have you call us. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That'll access several local lines, 333-WILL, the call letters of the station here at the University of Illinois. Elsewhere, including listeners on the Internet, may punch in 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL is a toll-free call, and we'll put you live on the air with our guest, Stephen Carlson. Let's look a little bit at some of these clues you were talking about. What are some of the clues, humor, self-references that you found in this letter?
Okay. One of them regarding the manuscript. As I said, the handwriting itself shows signs of what we would call forgery, in that it was written too slowly for what it should be. And there's also that isn't the only manuscript that Smith published pictures of. There's another one. What we would call what he calls Marsava number 22, and that has a specimen of a variety of handwriting, and in the corner of the photo, there's this handwriting that looks like it should be 18th century handwriting, just like the manuscript. But Smith says it belongs to a 20th century person by the last name of Madiodes. And so what we have is the first bit of evidence from Smith that there is this 20th century individual who is imitating 18th century handwriting, and that handwriting shows the same signs of forgery: the blunt ends, the shakiness, and some of the letter shapes are the same. When it came time to track down who this person Madiodes could be. It's not a Greek surname. I couldn't find him in the Greek telephone directory or anything like that, and it appears to be a pseudonym, and the pseudonym has the Odes ending of many Greek surnames, but the root word comes from mazo, which means either pluck hair or become bald, and it has an extended meaning of to swindle or to cheat. And so it's kind of interesting because Morton Smith was bald. And so what we have is a reference that Smith put in the catalog to somebody who was imitating earlier handwriting and whose name means baldy. So that was one of the first of the clues.
Now, as you were getting into this and looking at this material, were there people who were encouraging you, or were there people who were discouraging you? Either way,
I've got several friends in the academic community, and they were encouraging me.
Now, when you began to find some of these clues and began to think that this might be a hoax, did you have in mind writing a book about it?
Not initially. I was gonna write an article, and in fact, I wrote an article. But I showed it to a professor of New Testament at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. And he said that this article is too long to be printed in that. I think you should publish it as a book. And so he connected me with Baylor University Press, and now it's become a book.
And when did it come out?
It came out last week.
So it's just hot off the press, literally, from Baylor University Press.
Yes.
And is it too soon? Have there been any reviews of your book?
There's been several reviews. Some people we have on the back of the book two professors, Mark Goodacre and Larry Hurtado, who both think it's a wonderful case. Goodacre says it's fascinating, compelling, and utterly convincing. We also have Craig Evans at Acacia, divinity school, and he really likes it too. He thinks it's overwhelming.
Now, your book that's just out is called The Gospel Hoax. Does it have a subtitle?
Yes, the subtitle is Morton Smith's Invention of Secret Mark.
And so these are people who are able to see a pre-publication copy of the book.
Yeah.
Manuscript. Okay. All right. Now, you're going to be speaking here at the University of Illinois. When will that be?
It's supposed to be this coming week, but it's being postponed for until early next year.
Okay. So you're not sure of the date yet.
Right.
Okay. Well, people in this local area can watch for that. Stephen Carlson, author of The Gospel Hoax, published by Baylor University Press just out last week. Because of its just being published, I've not been able to see a copy, and so I have no opinion, but I'm eager to have a chance to look at it. Let's talk a little bit about the procedure that you went through in analyzing this. You saw some of these clues that it might be a practical joke. Do you have any idea what motivated Smith other than his sense of humor? He did get a couple publications out of it, but he already had tenure by this point, so academic progress probably wouldn't.
Right. I think it's a combination of things. When any time you get an undertaking of this magnitude, there isn't any like one motive per se, but if you look at the time in his career, he had been denied tenure, even though he was by all accounts a brilliant man.
And that was at Brown.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
but by the time he was publishing about this, he already had tenure. You said at Columbia since 1962.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he crafted this text, I think in part to prove pretty much to himself, but also that he is indeed smarter than everyone.
I see.
And but he was also fascinated with the reception of texts and forgeries. And so when he went to publish it, he wanted anybody commenting on it to basically send him a copy of any article, and he was that they would publish so he could track that. And he was just kind of clear that this was at the time when there were many kind of texts being discovered from the Middle East. You have the whole Nag Hammadi corpus, which has all these apocryphal works such as the Gospel of Thomas that they were being found.
Sure.
And so how those texts were received and what scholars did with that was fascinating to Smith. And particularly, he didn't like double standards where people would take seemingly strong evidence against their case and they would basically make up ways of kind of saying, we don't like this, we're going to ignore it, kind of that. And so I suspect he wanted to craft a text that nobody could ignore, and he wanted to see how people would handle it.
And so what procedure did you use as you began this study? What did you look at first?
It's a variety of things. My argument is that there's three different compositions being involved. It's the actual manuscript, the text of the Clement letter, and the text of Secret Mark. And in each of those compositions, there's evidence that they are not what they appear to be. Usually it's an anachronism or something. The second set of evidence is that there's evidence linking each of them to the 20th century. And then the final bit of evidence being collected is that there's a specific link to Smith himself. For example, with the manuscript, right, it's not that there's this pseudonym of this that means a bald swindler or whatever, but there's anomalies in the handwriting of the manuscript that don't fit 18th century manuscripts from Marsaba at that time. Basically, the Library of Congress has a nice collection of them, and I've been able to get microfilms of it. And some of those letters, particularly the Lambda, in the text that Smith had, they don't match the shape of what was being written at Marsaba at that time. I was able to get samples of Smith's handwriting. He had donated his library of a personal library to the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. And he had often scribbled in the margins of this book, so I was able to get his Greek handwriting just by looking at those books. And I found that those letters that were out of place, the shapes of those letters that were out of place, if it was a true 18th century manuscript, his own Greek handwriting matched them. So basically, Smith's handwriting accounts for the anomalies in the manuscript text itself. And so that was a very important clue and evidence linking Smith to the production of the manuscript. And you could go that for the Clement letter to Theodore as well, and for Secret Mark as well.
We're about halfway through our program of Keeping the Faith today. We're talking by phone to Fairfax, Virginia, with author Stephen Carlson, who is an attorney who has recently presented a case in a book published just last week by Baylor University Press called The Gospel Hoax, about Morton Smith purportedly finding this reference to a secret Gospel of Mark from New Testament times. We'll be getting back to our guest in just a moment, but let me take a moment to let listeners know who we'll be talking with and about what on upcoming programs. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith here on AM 580, WILL, a radio service of the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. We're a listener-supported radio station, and we are always grateful for gifts of people who make these kind of programs possible. This is a live program, and people who would like to call in with a comment or question are encouraged to do that. Our numbers are 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. If it's a long-distance call, including people who are listening on the net at WILL.UIUC.edu, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Coming up next week, we'll be talking with Larry Lieberman, a poet, professor emeritus of English here at the University of Illinois, about his new book. We have a short series on poetry. Kevin Stein, the current poet laureate of the state of Illinois, will be our guest December 11th, reading and talking about his most recent book, American Ghost Roses, published by the University of Illinois Press. On December 18, Father George Pyle, who is a Greek Orthodox priest, will be talking about keeping the holidays holy, secular encroachment into the feast days. And on December 25th, we'll be talking with Cliff Kindy in an interview taped just a week or so ago about his experience on a Christian peacemaking team that spent the last 5 months in Iraq. So those are some of the programs coming up during the month of December on Keeping the Faith here from 5 to 6 Central Time on WILL AM 580. Coming up in Champaign-Urbana this coming Tuesday, November 29 at 7 o'clock, Stories from Iraq. Two speakers, possibly three, will be at the Community United Church of Christ, corner of 6th and Daniel, at 7 o'clock this Tuesday. Tala Al-Fayyad and Mohammed Al-Hiti, who also recently spent time in Iraq, will be making a presentation on what they learned from a Muslim perspective. That's this Tuesday. Coming up December 3rd, Saturday, also at Community United Church of Christ, will be the annual Peace Bazaar, an alternative gift fair, from 9 to 3. That's December 3rd, Saturday. Parking's available around at the church and at university lots nearby. Many alternative gifts for the holiday season are for sale, and these have all been donated, and money goes to several local groups promoting peace and social justice. This is sponsored by the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, the Muslim Women's Outreach Group, Unitarian Universalist, McKinley Presbyterian Foundation, UCC Campus Ministry, Friends Meeting, as well as Community United Church of Christ. UNICEF cards will be sold at the University Y each weekday noon from 11:45 to 1:15. That's at the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, 1001 South Wright. Stop by the Y at noon and perhaps have lunch and look over at a selection of holiday cards that benefit UNICEF. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided by the University YMCA, which is the oldest student organization continuously operating at the university. Started just 6 years after the university began, now in its 132nd year. I'm the director at the University Y and happy to be involved in the various programs that benefit the campus and the community. The University Y is looking for community instructors to start up in January when we start our next series of classes. If you know something and would like to teach something, maybe you've made an investigation into a hoax. whatever it is, if you'd like to teach a class that might be interesting to others, do give us a call at the Y. Ask for Paul or Becca, 337-1514 in area code 217. We've just received at the Y another vehicle as part of our vehicle donation program, and we're having it a few repairs done to it. But if you would like to donate a car or a truck or a motorcycle or a van or even a boat, do give me a call, Steve Shoemaker. Part of the way we continue our work at the Y, encouraging students to do volunteer service and social justice activities, is because of people who donate vehicles. So give me a call at the Y, University YMCA, during the week. A reminder that Religion and News Ethics News Weekly with host Bob Abernathy is on our sister television station each Sunday from 12:30 to 1. That's Religion and Ethics News Weekly on WILL-TV. Well, let's get back to our guest. We are talking with Stephen Carlson about his new book, The Gospel Hoax. And I see we have a caller patiently waiting on line one. You're on the air with our guest. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask a question of your guest.
Yes.
Since this is Christmas time, and this is a very important issue now at the moment, I wonder if it will be popular at Christmas, or is it too esoteric a question? And I'll hang up and listen to the answer off the air. Thank you.
It is a Christian holiday coming up. Any reaction to that? Is this a subject that might be of interest for people in this holiday season?
I think the subject would be of interest to the informed layman person who likes to watch Nova or other those kind of PBS programs. It is somewhat technical, but you don't need to know a lot of that to understand the case. So if you're the type who likes to watch PBS and that, I think it would be a good book for that.
Where did you receive your legal training?
I got my legal training at George Mason University.
Did you grow up in any particular religious family?
My parents were Unitarian.
Uh-huh. And all the biblical material intimidate you at all, or was this something that you had been curious about for a while?
I've been curious about it. As far as the Greek is concerned, I studied Homer, so the Greek of the New Testament's a little easier than that. But I find it fascinating, and so. As a result, I really like studying the texts of the New Testament in particular.
Let's look at the one text that that might have been a spur to Morton Smith in creating this, if that's indeed what he did, in the Gospel of Mark that's in the New Testament, in chapter 14, there's this very enigmatic verse, 51, that comes right after Jesus is arrested, and it reads like this: "A certain young man was following him," referring to Jesus, "a certain young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and ran off naked." Then the next scene is Jesus before the council. There's no reference to this, no obvious reference to this young man before or after this one very strange verse. It's found in none of the other Gospels. What do you think? Do you think that might have been where this whole notion got started in Morton Smith's mind, if he did fabricate it?
Definitely. This has been a passage of Mark that has really perplexed people for a long time. Some have suggested it's Mark's reference to himself, which is basically anybody's guess is as good as another. But if you take the there's definitely a textual link between that passage of Mark and the passage in Secret Mark, where they refer to the same young man with described the same way with a linen cloth around his naked body, and I found that to be one of the things. As an attorney, I read the Supreme Court decisions. And in the Supreme Court decision on Lawrence v. Texas, which Supreme Court legalized same-sex sodomy, the pointed out that the legal regime of regulating same-sex behavior had actually changed very much throughout the whole course of history in the country. When the country was founded, even though they had laws on the books against same-sex behavior, because of the rules of evidence, an accomplice was considered incompetent to give evidence. So as a result, consensual behavior couldn't be prosecuted due to a lack of evidence if it was done in the privacy of one's home. Clearly, you know, public behavior or non-consensual behavior such as rape could be prosecuted. So that's the reason why one of the reasons why the Supreme Court struck down these laws against same-sex behavior is that that particular way in the privacy of one's home couldn't be prosecuted when the Constitution was written, and so it's fascinating to see the development of the laws in that. And because of that limitation, the whole kind of vice movement at the beginning of the 1900s decided to start using municipal ordinances to combat what they viewed is this, what they call the scourge of homosexuality, or however they kind of thought of that. And so they forbid people from congregating in public places like parks for the purpose of soliciting someone to perform an unnatural act, as the statutes would say, and in New York, it was in effect from 1926 to 1986, and in the 1950s, particularly in the mid 1950s, which is one of the most oppressive periods in American history against gay men, they were the police were arresting like 1,000 people a year for violating this kind of ordinance, which is meeting in a public park for the purpose of performing same-sex activity. And so what we find at the height of this thing, out pops this text from a faraway monastery that happens to make Jesus a violator of this ordinance, because it would appear that he was in the Garden of Gethsemane arrested because of this act with this certain young man who has this naked linen cloth over us. And Secret Mark hints that the problem was the problem was homosexuality. If you research the ancient laws, homosexuality was not against the law. So Clement would have not have had would not have seen the legal implications of this text. But to have a discovery refer to a specific legal regime used in oppressing gay men right at its height was to me an extremely important clue about when it came out. It's a very datable reference.
Now, when Morton Smith, who has since died, as you mentioned earlier, came out with his books about the secret gospel of Mark, how explicit were his books in terms of talking about this supposed homosexual relation of Jesus with this young man that had been kept secret over these 2,000 years?
You get a couple of very veiled references. I could read you one of them, but he basically, I can't find it right now, but basically he says that it was probable that a spiritual union was followed by a physical union, and it may have involved manipulation of the hands, and he said that Jesus was very good with his hands, or something like that. And so that was about the most he winked at it, but it was enough to upset a lot of people.
Now, when your book, which was just published last week, was in the process of trying to find a publisher, was it difficult for you to find a publisher?
No, not really.
But since you're not a professor, you're not an academician, had you submitted it to other places before Baylor published it?
I submitted to Baylor on the recommendation of one of the professors who reviewed the manuscript.
I see.
And he thought that there was another book coming out proving it's a hoax as well. And if I went with Baylor, I could get my book published first.
I see. And has that been the case? Is there another book on the way, or do you know?
I found out, I don't know too many details, but I found out that Yale University Press is going to be publishing a book next year that argues it from a completely different angle.
Who's the author of that, if you know?
I've been told it's Peter Jeffrey of Princeton.
Huh, okay. So this is a hot topic, as we say.
Yes.
However, there are defenders of Morton Smith. Now, we apparently don't have any listening to us today who would call in and argue on the other side. But what kind of arguments do your opponents make in support of the authenticity of this?
I haven't really seen a detailed treatment because a lot of this analysis this analysis that I'm bringing to it is cross-disciplinary, mm-hmm. and there's not a lot of experience with forensic handwriting analysis among people in the field. So I sense that there's a little bit of a wait and see going on.
Okay. In terms of the biblical scholars, there are people who have written other books looking at this same text and coming up with theories as to why this might have been hidden all these years and why it may be authentic. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. In about the late 70s, early 80s, there's been there was a flurry of interest in trying to see how secret Mark fits in relation to the other Gospels. And so there were two scholars who came up with reasons why they think the secret Mark may have been earlier than our Mark. But then sometime in the mid-80s, interest in it has kind of died down, and so the secret gospel gets kind of this brief mention that this thing is out there, but We think it's second century, and it's really too late for us to deal much with it.
We're down to our last 6 or 7 minutes of this program. We probably could sneak in another phone call if someone has a question or comment for our guest. The numbers are 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free number that will work anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet. In Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455 to join the conversation with attorney Stephen Carlson. What was the part of this that surprised you the most as you started doing this analysis of the handwriting and so forth?
I think the part of me that surprised me the most is how well that Morton Smith did not actually, when you read through his books, he didn't actually lie about the origin of the text. Everything's so precisely worded that it could be true whether the text was real or false. And when Smith did his major work on the historical Jesus, which is Jesus the Magician, came out in 75, it didn't use secret mark at all, even though some people thought it would or thought it should. And so even in the midst of this hoax that he did, there's this, I got this strong sense of another streak of integrity running through him that he couldn't really lie in print about it, and that when he did real work he wouldn't rely on it. Basically, his work apart from this stands on its own, and I think it's confused a lot of people because they expect from a forgery that people would forge things to support their theories, but he did not use this to support his theories at all.
And you said you were impressed not only with the sense of humor of Morton Smith, but also his brilliance.
Yes. He is. His Greek is excellent, and he knows so much that the few people who tried to challenge him on secret mark were vastly outmatched, and so I think that's one reason why there wasn't much challenge to it during his lifetime.
What do you think he would say or write about your book? You're calling it a hoax. You're calling it a fabrication, perhaps a practical joke, but nevertheless a falsification. How would he respond?
Hopefully, would say good job.
You think he might secretly wish to be exposed?
I think that was part of him there, because I can't see these clues being planted for any other reason. And so part of it is part of it was kind of a dare. It's basically I dare you to do that. And he would hide these in places where scholars would not check. I think one of his beefs is that scholars would rarely follow up the references. So for this reference about Mr. Mathiotis, it's published in a journal printed in Jerusalem, and it's hard to get copies of it. And so it's pretty clear that almost no one has actually read that catalog entry.
But isn't there a tremendous risk in even a scholar with tenure perpetuating something that is a hoax? Because universities can kick people out for doing such things. Why would he take this risk?
When he crafted it to begin with, he didn't have any tenure at all. and when he published it, I think the reaction from his colleagues was so positive among many respects that he didn't think there was a large risk of being found out. Although he does have enough clues in there that if he ever wanted to claim credit for it, he could point those out.
Any final words in our last minute of something that you found that you'd like to share with our listeners? In this long process, how long has it taken you?
It's taken me 2 years. And one of the things is that that I've learned that any kind of major undertaking, even in history, there's always a little bit about ourselves that's kind of invested in it. And forgers and fakers, even when they try to reconstruct the past and do it, there's always a little bit kind of left. And so as a result, 50 years later, we could kind of see that that extra added element there. And it's only because of the passage of time that some of these things stand out. So the message I have is really a message of hope with a lot of fakes is that sometimes, even though like the brightest person of the day can't is able to pull the wool over everyone's eyes, it can't stand the test of time.
We'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank our guest today by phone from Fairfax, Virginia, Stephen Carlson, a patent attorney. His study was done at George Mason University in law. His book is published by Baylor University Press just last week, called The Gospel Hoax, about the secret gospel of Mark that he claims was fabricated by religion professor Morton Smith, who died in 1991. Stephen Carlson will be on campus next semester discussing this with some people who take the opposite side, and we look forward to hearing him in person, and we'll be letting listeners know when that will be in the Department of Classics here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thank you to our listeners. Coming up later on Keeping the Faith in December, Professor Larry Lieberman will be our guest December 4, reading from and talking about his newest book of poetry. Larry Lieberman is the editor for the University of Illinois Press poetry series. December 11, another poet, our current poet laureate for the state of Illinois, Kevin Stein, will be talking about his book, American Ghost Roses, published by the University of Illinois Press. Father George Pyle will be our guest on December 18, talking about keeping the holidays holy and secular encroachment into feast days. And Cliff Kindy will be our guest on December 25th, recently returned from Iraq for 5 months as part of a peacemaking team. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Karen Armstrong was a Catholic nun who stopped believing. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program, To the Best of Our Knowledge, Armstrong shares her story of how she found her way back to God. Also Parker Palmer on how to keep going when life stops making sense. And that good old existentialist Charlie Brown. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, then showers and thunderstorms after midnight. Breezy with the low in the lower 50s and south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely in the morning. Breezy with the high in the upper 50s, then temperatures falling into the 40s during the afternoon. South winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.
From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life, distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Ira Glass. Back when we started our radio show, one of the things that we had to do is write a contract for all the people who did stories for the show that would basically give us permission to put their stories on the air. And it wasn't actually clear to us how long those contracts should cover, you know? How many years should we get the rights to rebroadcast our stories? And so we just had to pick a number. And we thought, what is the longest possible time that we could possibly imagine